Welcome to Cisco Tech Beat, the podcast that explores the people and stories behind what inspires the newest innovation. I'm your host, AB, and today I'm hanging with Jeetu Patel, Cisco's EVP and General Manager, Security and Collaboration. Jeetu and his team are the driving force behind Cisco's security vision and strategy, further accelerating the company's transformation and growth, and building world-class products and solutions that solve our customers' biggest problems. I had the pleasure of meeting Jeetu a few months back in person at Cisco Live 2022, and now we get to chat again. Welcome to the show, Jeetu.
AB, good to see you, man. How are you doing?
I am good. So I want to dive right into security, if I may, because you're the leading voice of security at Cisco, and I know you have a huge responsibility when it comes to ensuring that the products and the services we provide our customers are secure, regardless of platform or location. And the phrase that keeps popping up that I hear is security resilience. So what exactly is security resilience, and why is it so important when we think about the ever-evolving world of hybrid and remote work?
Yeah, and if you think about security, it's basically a critical part of the infrastructure where your entire business operations can come to a standstill when you have a breach or when you encounter a breach. And the reality is that most companies at some point in time or the other might encounter a breach. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Right.
However, what's important for companies is that just like when you have operational resilience or financial resilience, when something goes wrong, you're able to get back up. In security resilience, when you do have a breach, how quickly can you get back and operational is actually what's really, really important, especially in these days of ransomware attacks and all of that. So what we think about over here in the security team is how do you make sure that you increase an organization's resilience towards a security attack or a security breach? And that's what security resilience is how quickly can you come back up and operational from the time that you experience a breach? And the reality is look, the days that we live in right now, because so much is done digitally, your financial system can stop working with a security breach that occurs, or your water supply might stop, or your electric power grid might actually not be able to go out and deliver power to you. And what happens when these things happen is like lives are at stake, because imagine a hospital where the power goes down.
Right.
And, you know, you're in the middle of a surgery. These are like, you know, profound consequences that happen in society as a result of this. So the ability for an organization to stay resilient so that they can come back up to speed quickly. It's not the fact that you fell down. It's how quickly can you stand back up again is important. That's really important in security.
Absolutely. And to that end, one of the offerings we unveiled this year is Cisco Security Cloud, a platform we've designed to protect a company's entire ecosystem while delivering greater performance and economic value. How does Cisco Security Cloud work? What can it do for our customers? And why does this platform give us an advantage over our competitors?
Well, look, the Security Cloud, the way to think about this is you have to think about the problem that we're trying to solve firstly. If you look at how the market is evolving today, more and more customers want to be in a hybrid multi-cloud world, which means that they will go out and pick not one, but more than one vendor as a cloud provider, whether it be Microsoft or Amazon or GCP or their own private data center, and say, I'm going to make sure that I have my workload split across multiple of these because I don't want to get locked in to any of the public cloud providers. So what they're trying to do is get the public cloud economics, but not have the public cloud lock-in. So what role does Cisco play in this? Well, if you think about the way that the market has evolved right now, most of those infrastructure as a service providers, whether it be Microsoft, Google, Amazon, others, have optimized those infrastructure layers for their own cloud.
Right.
And so each one of them have created and provide their own services around compute, around storage, around network, around security. But if you now want to make sure that you don't want to get locked into any vendor, you want to make sure that you have networking and security get abstracted from the IaaS players. So if Cisco can be that vendor neutral third party that can acquire and steer all traffic to any of the cloud providers, but also then add a layer of security capabilities on top of that so that you can make sure that your policies apply no matter where your workload goes, that would be a profoundly strong value proposition. And so our goal in building out the security cloud is to abstract networking and security from the IaaS provider so that you can provide the public cloud economics for a customer without the public cloud lock-in and provide that vendor neutrality across any of your IaaS players in the market. And to deliver that effectively, we provide this thing called the Cisco Security Cloud, which is a global cloud-delivered service with a unified policy engine, with an open API, with the ability to be cloud-native, that is multi-cloud friendly, so that regardless of how you decide to move your workloads, you will have a common set of security parameters that can be applied without having to go out and have a huge amount of overhead and burden on management.
That's amazing. And that, I suspect that that would also give us more control over troubleshooting, since we are sort of owning several aspects of how security is delivered. We can go in and make quick fixes if there's an issue or if somebody wants something tweaked.
Yeah, I think the challenge that you have with this industry in general is there's about 3,500 vendors in this market.
Wow.
In security. And no one owns more than 5 to 7% of the market. Because it's such a highly fractured market, what ends up happening is on average, most companies have 50 to 75 vendors within their environment, which means you have 50 to 75 different policy engines, 50 to 75 different places where you set policy. And then when something goes wrong, you have to make sure that the policy contention is managed. So what you're now starting to see happen is rather than going into this best of breed mode, what more and more customers are saying is, I want to go out and make sure that I increase my efficacy. And the way to increase efficacy is not optimize for every single small component, but to provide some kind of mechanism that I can have an end-to-end integrated platform that's delivered to the market. As we move into this integrated platform, your efficacy will end up going up because the way in which you set policy will be consistent and policy contention can be managed in an effective way. And the exception handling that happens will be done in a far more efficient manner. So the amount of overhead that a company has in managing a security infrastructure will over time need to go down because currently the way that we're doing it is untenable.
Let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about our mission at Cisco to build an inclusive future for all. And when we talk about that, we're pretty familiar with the idea of the digital divide, right? So certain individuals and communities have abundant access to technology while others never get an opportunity to use tech, which will give them the skills to sort of operate on an even playing field. I recently came across another term, though, that I'm not as familiar with, to be honest, which is called the security poverty line. I'd love to learn more about that. What exactly is it? And what are we doing to help eliminate it?
So this was actually a concept that was created by one of our employees, Wendy Nather. The concept of a security poverty line is that we live in a highly interconnected ecosystem right now. Organizations aren't operating as individual entities. They're operating as a part of an ecosystem. What does that mean? That means that the weakest link in the ecosystem can actually bring down the entirety of the value chain. So a recent example, an auto manufacturer had to shut down their entire production plant because there was a potential breach by one of the small component parts manufacturers. You could have a $100 product, and if someone has a 7-cent part, that 7-cent part having a breach can shut down your entire production line. That is a pretty profound set of implications that happens. And why does that happen? Because not everyone has the same capacity to go out and protect themselves against a breach. So those companies that sit below what we call the security poverty line, those companies who don't have the resources and don't have the influence and don't have the technology and the human capital to go out and be able to protect themselves against a breach, a sophisticated attack, because attacks are getting more and more sophisticated. Threat actors are getting more and more bespoke in the way that they go after someone. You can now be at risk of getting the entirety of the supply chain come to a standstill as a result of a small supplier who's below the security poverty line can actually make sure that they actually put the entirety of the supply chain at risk. So what we have started to think about is, what do we need to do to make sure that we can move people above the security poverty line? Because for anyone who's below the security poverty line, not only are they at risk, but they bring the entirety of the ecosystem that they connect to at risk. And that's a pretty large implication for how we operate as a world. And that's not how we used to operate a few years ago. A few years ago, if there was a large company would protect themselves and everyone else, each one would fend for their own. Now it's no longer tenable to do it that way because we operate as an interconnected ecosystem where the weakest link can have the most amount of exposure to the entirety of the ecosystem.
Yeah, so basically, not only do we have to make sure everyone's protected, we have to make sure everyone, even those who can't afford to protect themselves, receive the same kind of security protection, right?
we have to make sure that everyone's protected and that we actually, for those that can't afford to be effectively protected, not just from a financial perspective, but because they don't have the right talent or they don't have the right sophistication or influence or what have you, we as a community have to come together to make sure that those folks do get protected, because the only way that the strongest stay safe is by the weakest getting protected.
Absolutely. Sticking on security phrases, another one that we hear a lot is zero trust or zero trust security.
Yes.
A lot of people throw that phrase around, but I don't think it's always explained in an easily digestible way. So what is zero trust? And can you give an example of a technology we've created to help achieve that?
What security is about is making sure that you establish trust. When AB logs into a system, I want to make sure that AB is who AB says AB is, and then make sure that I grant you access to what you've actually gotten the right level of permission set to go out and to do your job.
Right.
In the past, what would happen is when you logged into a network, you would have access to all the resources within the network. What now we are saying is that you want to operate in more of a zero trust manner. What that means is, provide the least amount of trust to someone to get the job done rather than the most amount of trust you can give them to get the job done. How do you provide the least privileged access rather than the most privileged access? So if I do want to log into a system, rather than logging into the entire network and all the applications on the network, AB, you want to go log into Workday. So I'm going to give you access to Workday because that's what you need to get the job done. That's what they call zero trust network access. How do I go out and, you know, so there's ways that you can do this. And the technologies that we're building are not just around making sure that we can, at the point of time of login, give people the ability to grant trust. But what we want to do is have that trust be granted on a continuous basis and evaluate the kind of behavior that that person is exhibiting and saying, AB is doing things that AB typically does, and so therefore give AB all the rights that AB needs.
Right.
But if at a later point in time, if the behavior seems different, then we need to make sure that we're continually monitoring for whether or not AB should be granted trusted access rather than a one-time point at the point in time of login. So to give you an example, you log into a system, it's from your home office, and you typically go connect on a browser from a certain computer, from a certain network. That device is a managed device, give you access to it. Now you're logging in from a different location and you're trying to go out and get the same kind of work done. You want to log into Salesforce and look at customer records. That's great, but you're going to be on the move. That still seems like what AB would do, give them access. But third time around, you're on a different computer from a different browser in a completely brand new location, and you're trying to download 6 million customer records. And that's not typically what AB does. So what do? We intercept at that point. The system is smart enough to detect that as an anomaly and then intercept at that point in time and say, you know what? This doesn't seem like regular behavior. This seems like anomalous behavior. So I'm going to put some more checkpoints for AB to actually overcome those hurdles before we give them the right to do whatever they're looking to do.
Yeah, I mean, that is cool. You're basically giving people a secure way to work, but you're giving them just enough access for them to be able to do their jobs as best as possible.
Yeah, what you want to do is you want to protect the organization while making sure that people actually get the job done, and do that on a continuous basis. Grant trust, not just at points in time, but grant trust on a continuous basis and evaluate the behavior. And if that behavior seems anomalous, then take action based on that anomalous behavior. You know, so for example, one of the things that's a great thing that we're putting together in this continuous trusted access system that we're putting in place is, hey, I happen to log into Salesforce or Box and I want to download a file, and I'm going to always allow for my session with Box to be, you know, solid as long as my disk encryption is turned on. The moment I turn off my disk encryption, my Box connection is disconnected.
Mm.
I'm smart enough to know, hey, when you logged into Box, your disk encryption was turned on, but now you've turned off disk encryption or you've turned off your device firewall. And that was a policy that our team said that we have to make sure that disk encryption is turned on. And therefore, we will actually talk with the SaaS system and say, okay, you know, kind of terminate the connection. Those are the kind of things we have to make sure that we get more and more sophisticated about.
Yeah, better safe than sorry. I want to talk about your role a little bit, because obviously I've watched a lot of your keynotes and I listen to you talking on panels or in interviews. It's refreshing to see somebody who's passionate not only about the role, but about Cisco as a whole. You seem really fulfilled, and I don't know if you remember this, but during our video shoot at Cisco Live this year, you said something interesting that I still think about. You said, being fulfilled is different than being happy. In your experience, what is the distinction between fulfillment and happiness?
Well, eventually, fulfillment does bring about happiness, but not in every moment of the day. So the reason I say that is being fulfilled is more important than being happy on a day-to-day basis, because if you're working towards doing something that has a larger meaning, in that very moment, the job that you might be doing might not make you happy, but it's actually going to create long-term fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And that fulfillment over a period of time will bring you happiness and joy. But you have to make sure that you actually are focused on not just a momentary happiness, but a longer-term fulfillment as you're doing your work. There are going to be times where, look, there's not all parts of my job do I love. I don't love checking email. You know, I hate checking email. You know, but that's not like something I wake up and say, yeah, I want to go check email today. I don't like, you know, parts of my job where things aren't going well and there's things that we need to make, you know, there's some aspects of an operational aspect of a job that I might not really get that much energy from.
Sure.
But you have to do it because the larger mission that you're trying to go out and accomplish requires that to be done. And that's going to create fulfillment. But if you just think about the momentary joy that you're going to get from every single thing you do, you'll constantly be disappointed because like, oh, you know what? This doesn't make me happy. So therefore I'm not really, this is the wrong job for me. Every job's going to have some downside. You have to kind of take the good with the bad. But the fulfillment comes with long, prolonged kind of, you know, focus on the mission and execution and progress. And if you get fulfillment over the long run, you will actually start to derive a lot of joy from that fulfillment. But not always does the other way work. You might be happy on a few things and unhappy on a few things, but feel unfulfilled by the end of it. And it's not going to be as satisfying.
Yeah, this is cool. This reminds me of some of the conversations I've had with past guests about failure, you know, which I think is sometimes tied to happiness. You know, if you're failing at something and you're unhappy, then you find a way to be happy by moving on or shifting your perspective. If you're doing well, then you know you're doing the right thing. But either way, failure and happiness or lack thereof can actually be something positive in your career.
When I look for people that I look to hire, I think it's extremely important that they've experienced failure.
Right.
Because if they've never experienced failure, you won't have the grit to weather the storm when things get bad. Experiencing failure is an important part of life. And when people have experienced an equal amount of failure and success, not even equal amount, but have experienced both those states, success is actually sweeter because they know what failure feels like. You know, all of us have experienced some level of failure in our lives. It's just a matter of like, you know, the conditions that you've experienced failure actually really makes you a resilient human being.
I love that. Now, we were talking about jobs for a little bit, so let's switch gears completely here. I went to high school in Miami in the 80s, if you're interested, and one of the places my brother and I loved to go to on special occasions with our parents was Sizzler, a very family-friendly, all-you-can-eat restaurant that had pretty much all the good things that a hungry teenager could ever want, right? So now I suspect a lot of people don't know this, but I learned that you have an interesting connection to Sizzler. What did you do there? When was that? And how did that experience shape you on your journey to where you are now?
So for those of people that don't know what Sizzler is a kind of a steak and a salad restaurant that was a not quite fast food, but you would stand in line, make the order, and then you'd get your steak and all you can eat. And salad, you know, and it was kind of one of those restaurants which was in the same range as Ponderosa's and Applebee's and all of those. And I used to wait on tables. My first job was waiting on tables at Sizzler. And it was, I would say, the job that prepared me the most for, because I used to stutter as a kid. And Sizzler was where I actually stopped stuttering. The reason was your mental state got very different because if you weren't friendly, and I was very introverted as a kid and I was very shy. And so if you didn't go out and break out of your comfort zone and got into conversations with strangers who were, and you got them entertained, you wouldn't get a good tip.
That's right.
Well, most people don't know this. The average number of trips that we made to a table were about 7. Average tip that we got per table was about $1. So it was a much higher number of trips frequency-wise because they would order up front, but it was all you can eat. So you had to keep going to the table, but you'd actually get less tips than what you would get at a typical restaurant. And so if on a good night, you'd make $40. On a bad night, you make $15, you know. And so it was kind of you had to work pretty hard. But what Sizzler did for me was, you know, I don't think I would be able to have done public speaking the way I do today if it weren't for Sizzler, because it broke the anxiety for being able to speak to people. And, you know, so I was super shy, super introverted as a kid. And that got me to get out of my comfort zone. And so I have a lot of gratitude for that job. It really helped out quite a bit. I still have the badge for me being a service supervisor. I'd gotten promoted.
Oh, wow.
And it was, I still, I think, have that badge, or I might have recently kind of thrown it out with everything else, but I had it for a very long time.
That Sizzler flair, right? I'm sure you had a bunch of stuff.
And it was great. It was a great company. And they're still around. I'd love to go visit them one of these days.
You know, it's funny. I have a lot of actor friends, and a lot of them wait tables. Of course, it's kind of like a tradition for a lot of actors to wait tables. And a lot of them say the same thing. They say the constant having to be in front of different people, not just people, but different people. You learn a lot about people, and you're sort of forced to adapt and acclimate depending on who you're serving. So I can see how that would be sort of a natural environment to kind of get comfortable having conversation on any level with a variety of interesting individuals, right?
You know, I'll tell you this, waiting on tables is probably one of the most valuable experiences I had in my, as I was beginning my career, because it teaches you so much. It teaches you customer success. It teaches you responsiveness. It teaches you being quick on your feet. It teaches you engaging with people and making sure that you actually have a conversation with them. I mean, there were these lessons that you learned from that were just impossible to have learned otherwise. It teaches you grit. It teaches you that some days you're going to have bad days and some people aren't going to tip you well, and you're going to still keep going because the next table is going to be better.
Absolutely. Let's move away from work completely here, both past work lives and current work life, and go back to something that we were talking about in June when we first met, which was something about one of your hobbies. So you mentioned that you had, at that time, recently taken up cycling again after a recent injury. When you think about stepping away from the craziness that is just work in general, obviously we are also bombarded by all these global events happening that are impacting our lives personally as well as our work lives. Is cycling that go-to activity for you when it comes to trying to decompress? Or are there other hobbies that you sort of involve yourself in to just forget about the stresses of life?
I'm not like a hardcore cyclist or anything. I bought a bike recently. I do like, you know, 20 or 30 miles on the weekends. I'll go for a bike ride or something and do 20 miles or 30 miles or something and come back. So 2-3 hours. Nothing beyond that. I'm not like a 100-mile biker. But I'd say that the way that I try to decompress is physical exertion. I love exercising. I don't love exercising. I actually hate exercising. I do it because it feels better. And when I have not done it, I've actually found myself regressing.
Sure.
So right now I'm doing pretty well, but that changes every so often. The things that I love doing are, you know, like I love dancing. I love going on a bike ride. I love the feeling after a workout. I love anything that gets you in the zone where you forget about everything else. I love design. So any kind of home architecture, interior design or something, I'm really a big fan of that. So those are the kind of things I'll try to dabble on. But I love hanging out with my daughter.
Sure.
As she's getting older, though, I'm starting to hang out less and less with her because she's got her own things that she does. And so it's kind of like, you know, and she's like, when I go to her, it's like, if she's not ready, she's like, I'm not ready for you right now. Come back later. And so,
yep. They're pretty strong minded as they get into those years. I don't have a daughter. I have a son. He's 15, but I can relate. It's almost like that, you know, they hit this sort of this time in their lives when they really just don't need you at that point. Unless they really need you, so.
She's finding it harder and harder to justify spending time with me compared to her friends. Her friends are way cooler. Yep.
That's okay. That happens to all of us, G2, so it's not particular to you. You're okay. Well, I tell you what, this has been amazing. I just want to thank you so much for making time to chat today. I'm really glad we got to reconnect. I know we're going to connect again very soon, but just having you on the show has been wonderful. And again, thank you for your time, and I appreciate the conversation today.
AB, I appreciate you having me, man. It's always a pleasure, and keep up the good work. I think you folks are doing a great job.
Thank you. Thank you so much.